KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. And at 10 o'clock, don't forget about Health Watch. We'll hear an interview with Dr. Nayakai Goldberg, author of the Woman's Healthy Heart Program, Life-Saving Strategies for Preventing and Healing Heart Disease. I'm so sorry about ruining that name. At 10:30 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen discusses which vegetable seeds should be started indoors from January through March. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman interviews author Alice Walker. For the entire hour, here comes the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
As for me, I'm proud of it. This Monday morning on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio. No commercials, just some tasteful endorsements, but little compromises. They're not as bad as big betrayals. Monday morning at 9, our Old Mole Variety Hour, dedicated to those funny little moles. Altogether, they have such great power, just going about their lives, digging their burrows, hunting out those tasty roots and grubs. They undermine the foundations of the great surface structures. Give a mole enough years in the armories, the parliaments, prisons, and pentagons of power, they fall to the dust. One fine day, these imposing, why, they look like they'd last 1,000 years. But big gaping cracks appear and widen and soon later fall to dust. That's, of course, a metaphor for human history. Humans go about their lives seeking dignity, seeking self-determination, seeking to control their own lives. And lo and behold, all the great empires have fallen. The absolute monarchies no more, hereditary power ended. Their great palaces now tourist traps. And the bureaucratic states with their great pretensions, they collapse too, because people won't be dominated, and our new princes of commerce, riding high in their new world order, their reign will last no longer than the others. Sooner or later, the democratic tide will wash them away. Yes, history is with us. With us, moles. May it come, of course, in my lifetime, which is unfortunately unlikely. Today on the Old Mole, this is the day after our, or is this the day of our great commercial Valentine's Day? Florists really love it. Halloween's for candy, July 4th is firecrackers, and today, or whatever it was, yesterday it's roses. So Fran Michelle introduces us to Audre Lorde's Uses of the Erotic. She's doing a well-read read. Our movie moles, Fran and Jan Hocken, review the film Why We Fight. Near the hour's end, I interview Fred Hewitt of the Sierra Club and other organizations on climate change and energy issues and why working folks would be well-served getting behind environmental campaigns. And we begin today with Carol Dyer and Sakura Kone from Common Ground in New Orleans, trying to rebuild sustainably, of course, and save that city for working people. Carol Dyer and Sakura Kone, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Tell us what you're doing in the big uneasy.
Well, as we speak right now, there's a dire emergency that's occurring. Your listeners may or may not be aware of, but FEMA is proceeding with the first phase of forced evictions of the residents from hotels and other accommodations. We have our people in the courts. Already, has there been the march has occurred yet, Carol?
Well, they've been gathering at the city hall today and sending groups out to the different hotels to find out the most up-to-date information. And I'll actually be getting text messages as we're on this, finding the most updated information.
Yeah, are they also giving people free bus fares to nowhere, somewhere else?
Yeah.
I mean, they're trying to get poor people out of New Orleans, is basically.
Yeah, they got to make way for, you know, more important things like Mardi Gras. So never mind the fact that FEMA's is paying for folks being in a hotel. They want to be able to jack up the hotel costs three or four times the amount that FEMA is paying them and accommodate the tourists for Mardi Gras.
Oh, is that the, that's part of it. The Mardi Gras, of course, in the French Quarter, where they've managed to restore electricity and restore life in the French Quarter.
Yeah, Mardi Gras actually is all over the place. And actually, I don't even know if FEMA, the cost of the hotels is maybe less of an issue as it is the people who are in those hotels.
Right.
They want to encourage the tourism rather than the residents of the hotels, residents
of
New Orleans.
Who's doing the Mardi Gras, though? There's got to be people there to do it. Are they importing performers from God knows where?
There are some local musicians who are still there, some from out of the area that they'd like import in momentarily, never mind the fact that the vast majority of musicians, like the vast majority of poor working class and even middle class residents are without home, without shelter. The important thing is to have them there momentarily for Mardi Gras, and then, you know, they can just disappear after that.
All right, but they live close enough. Have they been able to, I assume they're doing Mardi Gras the way Disneyland does its sort of, you know, whatever they are, performances, shows, entertainment, sort of, or Las Vegas style big things. But a lot of community groups also participated in Mardi Gras, didn't they? They had these ancient uniforms.
Yes.
I remember the whole, I mean, it was very, very, a mix of Disneyland,
yes,
but also real people.
It's a culture for the residents, long-term residents who've been there from generation to generation ever since slavery and even before slavery. It is a cultural celebration of the unity between the blacks and the Native American who have had this historic alliance, and it's celebrated in Mardi Gras with the Indian costumes. As a matter of fact, some of the musical heads of the different bands, they call themselves chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh, really?
Like the Big Chief Al and Big Chief Monk and so forth and so on. But that's paying a homage and honor towards the unity, the historic unity that occurred, especially during slavery, where when slaves would escape from the plantation, the only place inside of America that would accommodate their escape would be our red brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. And so but to do Mardi Gras now, which they're trying to do, I guess, just to show them New Orleans is still alive, at least the French Quarter and the tourist areas and stuff, they've got to have people. Have enough people from the poor and working class communities? Are they there? Have they reconstituted their groups and their celebrations?
Make no bones about it. It's going to be mostly tourists that's going to be in attendance. You're talking about the audience.
I'm talking about the people who
participate. Those are the entertainers. Some are there.
Some are there.
You know, but most aren't. But they will be imported.
Well, they are being imported.
You know, but it's going to be momentarily, mind you. I mean, after the hoopla is over, they're not going to have any home to go to. So they're going to have to go back where they were, in Nevada or Maine or Rhode Island or New York or San Francisco. They're going to have to go back there or go back to dilapidated housing conditions full of moles or move in where they're already overcrowded family or relatives. Those are the options that's going to be left to them, or be homeless.
Right. You people, let's go to what Common Ground is doing. You're trying to prevent that displacement. And basically, I think Barney Frank was right. It's sort of an ethnic cleansing of New Orleans by neglect and by not giving loans to people and by... what are you doing? I know you're active in the Ninth Ward and other wards that were really horribly flooded. What's the story on the ground?
Well, what Common Ground is trying to do, when people came into, flocked to New Orleans, as an act of solidarity, solidarity for the people most affected by the disaster, and solidarity to try to provide some kind of direct relief, temporary direct relief and then stick around to help create systems and structures within the city that can be community led. So, for example, when we got in there, what I may have come to do is solidarity to support my African American friend Malik Rahim, and to stand in the way of white vigilante groups acting with violence against them. But then I ended up handing out water and food and distributing what we call sanitation kits, basic sanitary supplies for people, and ended up being involved in these distribution centers and doing mobile distribution in the hardest areas where the Red Cross and other relief organizations weren't entering, and many places they came in for a minute and now they're gone. Mm-hmm. So what we've created is five distribution centers, one primary care medical clinic open 5 days a week, one and then a first aid station to help provide vaccinations and a first aid treatment for people when in some areas of the city there's a 17 to 19 minute ambulance response time. So we're trying to provide a mutual aid program that allows people to get the services they need without having to leave the city of New Orleans because so many stores are closed.
These are people who've come back to the badly flooded and ruined areas and are trying to sort of restore them and build lives there. So mm-hmm. you're providing medical care. You're bringing food in as well?
Yeah, we have in our distribution centers, we'll have food and water and clothing and soap and razors, mm-hmm. Available for residents returning, but also for people coming in to assess the situation. A lot of people come back. We can see a lot of examples in the Ninth Ward. People come back and they want to go look at their house, but they don't have anything. Right. They don't have access to a restroom, much less access to food that they can eat while they're assessing the situation while cleaning their homes.
This is KBU Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mold Variety Hour, talking to Sakura Kone and Carol Dyer from New Orleans, from Common Ground in New Orleans. It seems to me you've got a vision for New Orleans, and the rich people in New Orleans have a vision for New Orleans, right? And not just the rich people in New Orleans, the developers from all over the country. The rich have they like to develop cities on their lines, especially cities with sort of nice architecture where they can build more Disneylands and more gentrification and more sort of, chain industrial but fancy restaurants, that whole style. What's their vision? What's your vision?
Okay. First of all, in addition to what Carol just said in regards to our Paris and current projects, we have this legal committee that's in the courts right now lobbying, pleading, cajoling to try
and fighting and bringing cases, probably
these people from being thrown out of the various temporary shelters that they are in. Right?
Uh-huh.
So that's what's happening with our pro bono legal committee, while our members of Common Ground, along with the residents, I won't go into details on what their plans are, except to say that they are showing force by being there at the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
We also have these cleaning crews that work along with the residents who are there to put their homes into livable conditions,
uh-huh.
to gut the homes, remove the mold, repair roofs, and so these folks are able to live there in terms of the homes. We also do that for the owners and proprietors of churches and community centers and warehouses. But the arrangement we have with those proprietors of these larger facilities is that we will clean them up for them in return for allowing us the volunteers at Common Ground, which we've numbered about 2,000 since September the 5th.
You've had 2,000 volunteers. How many are on the ground right now?
On the ground right now, we have approximately 150.
150 people?
Yes, if you include not only the Common Ground volunteers, but our legal clinic members of the legal clinics, who are like law students or paralegals, as well as the medical clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, so we use these facilities for several months. This is the agreement that we have, and then we turn it over to the proprietors. We turn it back over as a church or as a community center or as a warehouse in better condition than what we found it in. And then we move on.
What are you doing with the public facilities, like the schools in the area?
Well, other than advocate that the schools be reopened, because, you know, most of the kids are not in school. Most of the kids who are there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The vast overall majority, they are in other cities.
Right.
But the ones who are there, they are not in school. Some of them are in school, but the ones who are in school, they are in the charter school.
Mm-hmm.
So the city has pretty much turned the whole educational system over to the state, and the state has, put charter schools in charge of that endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say more about the actual project. Now, in regards to your specific question about our vision for the future, and the fact that there's a rich man's vision for the future, you know, corporate power structure, vision for the future. And then there is a political power structure, vision for the future, dictated to by the corporate power structure.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially it's this. It's indulging in disaster capitalism, which has worked really well abroad. And how that pattern or that process goes is that abroad, we destroy Afghanistan, we destroy Iraq, all right? So, okay, it's destroyed now. Then we take taxpayers' money to rebuild those countries. But we don't open it up to bid. We pick who's going to be rebuilding the country. We pick Halliburton, Bechtel, Keller, Brown, and Roof et al., who are our biggest political supporter. Now, when I say ours, I'm not talking mine's or Carol or yours, sir.
No.
We're talking about the political power structures. Whoever, you know, are that big funders, then we give them the no-bid contract, all right? And they go in, they do building, however flimsy it may or may not be. Then they take care of us in the next political cycle. And the cycle repeats itself. So disaster capitalism has been very, very fruitful and successful abroad. So why not implement it in America? All right? Knowing that this is going to be an unprecedented hurricane, knowing that New Orleans is under threat of being destroyed in advance, well in advance, you know, 20 years, 25 years. This knowledge is, you know, it's quite knowledgeable, been written about by the major newspaper in New Orleans, been talked about by the researchers at the various universities. So it was a foregone conclusion that this was going to occur, but nobody cared. No one of means cared. No one who controlled the purse strings cared.
Why really build dikes for the Ninth Ward and for all those poor people? Let it all flood, and then
Absolutely. And don't forget, in spite of the fact that Bush won Louisiana, he lost New Orleans. So they're Democrats, so forget them. You know, why shouldn't we do anything for
black.
Them?
Yeah, a lot of them
black
are
and poor,
yeah.
Black and poor, and working class.
Right.
But what you don't hear is that a majority of them are homeowners. They managed to eke out a living to buy a house, affordable house.
Yeah.
And the homes, unfortunately, that's the more affordable, the ones that are sub below sea level. All of New Orleans is below sea level. But the most devastated area was sub below sea level, and that's where they tend to buy their affordable homes.
Yeah.
What we're involved in is a revolution. All right? That's exactly what we're involved in New Orleans. We are in the battle for New Orleans, the second battle for New Orleans, you know, a la French Indian War. And our vision is that we want to rebuild New Orleans, but from a sustainable standpoint, from a green standpoint, appropriate technology, alternative energy, homes built with material that could withstand hurricane. We noticed that in the devastated Lower Ninth Ward, that the homes that withstood structural damage were cinder blocks and brick. Cinder blocks and bricks. Put that on stilts. All right? It's not rocket science. The Native American Indians, our brethren, the Homa Nation, been doing that for hundreds of years.
In New Orleans area, yeah.
Yes. They used to be in New Orleans before the white man and manifest destiny wiped most of their people out.
You're also for extending the barriers, though. All of that land that went into the Gulf of Mexico that's been destroyed by the oil companies and by the big barge companies, it seems to me that that whole area of, what's it called? It's not swamp, but it's...
Bayou.
The bayou has to be restored in order to protect New Orleans. Is that part
Absolutely.
Of your...
That's part of
that's
our
part
division.
Of your program. Right.
And building dikes that could withstand, at the very least, a level 5 hurricane.
Uh-huh. Now, it seems you call yourself Common Ground for a reason. And Common Ground is a wonderful historic notion. That is the commons, the people's commons, living on the commons and in the commons and communally. I gather that's part of your sort of sense, and you have that already with the people who are there now and the volunteers. It seems to me there really is a community forming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Common Ground is also about just coming together all different kinds of people, all classes, creeds, colors of people, coming together to try to support the people of the Gulf Coast. After the city and the state and the federal agencies dropped the ball, or maybe they never picked it up, the people came together and we said, all right, the state's not going to do it. We're going to make a difference. We're going to just do it. And we're going to listen to the community, and we're going to move forward. And we're going to provide the kind of services we want to see for ourselves and for the community of New Orleans. And stop depending on these systems that require exploitation, that require that require some kind of compromise to the values that we share in this common ground. We work with Methodists, we work with Baptists, we work with anarchists, we work all across the political spectrum.
Muslims, Green, Democrats, and Republican even. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some Republicans of conscience that have joined our ranks.
And that's an amazing process to watch.
Yeah. What kinds of I know it's probably chaotic and difficult right now, and you have people coming and going. Actually, volunteers come for a while and then they go back home and get a good bed and to sleep for a while, and then they come back, no doubt, to wherever they are.
I came in September. Like I said, to do solidarity work with Malik Rahim, the founder of the organization. Uh-huh. And I took me about 3 days to know that I would be there for 1 year. Uh-huh. And so some people have also made 3, 4, or 5 year commitments to helping in the rebuilding efforts.
We only have another minute. How can people help you?
Well, in short, go to the website, www.commongroundrelief.org.
Common Ground, is that all one word?
Yes.
Common Ground Relief. Although, I suppose if you Google Common Ground, will you get you on the first page?
You will get other organizations also.
There. Yeah, there's a lot of Common Ground.
So we recommend you put Common Ground Relief or Common Ground Collective, but okay. Common Ground Relief will give you the most feedback. We have our wish list there in terms of how people can help, about material support, tools, monetary support. Etc.
Political support, too.
Want to mention that here in Portland, there will be a Common Ground Collective chapter as a pipeline to the Gulf being created. And you'll be able to find out about that on commongroundrelief.org.
Oh, good. Sakra Kone and
yes.
Carol Dyer, thank you very much for talking to us.
We appreciate the invitation on such short notice.
Right. We'll keep touch with your comrades here in Portland. Thanks a lot.
And thank you for the listeners out there.
All right.
That was Carol Dyer and Sakra Kone from Common Ground Relief in New Orleans. Next on The Mole, we're now all taking turns at being well-read. friend Michelle is today's well-read. She's going to introduce us to Audre Lorde's essay, Uses of the Erotic.
Good morning, this is Fran Michelle, here with your well-read read for February 13th, 2006. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, a holiday for which consumer culture tells us to buy flowers and chocolate, diamonds and gold. Of course, consumer culture never tells us much of anything except to buy things. But beyond the cultural impoverishment of a world in which our central engagement with that world is presumed to be the acquisition of commodities, there are also some particular problems with these commodities. Flowers and chocolates, diamonds and gold are all parts of a globalized economy marred by dangers to workers and the environment. The majority of cut flowers sold in the United States are imported, especially from Colombia and Ecuador, where workers face low pay, repetitive motion injuries, pesticide fumigation, and resistance to their unionizing efforts. Chocolate that doesn't boast of its status as fair trade certified probably begins on cocoa plantations worked by enslaved child laborers, since, despite promises, Nestle and M&M Mars have failed to improve conditions for their impoverished young workers. More information about campaigns for workers' rights in both of these industries can be found through the International Labor Rights Fund, which you can find on the web at laborrights.org. Gold mining, in addition to the toxic waste it produces, consumes 7 to 10% of the world's available energy. For information on the environmental and human rights abuses associated with gold mining, you can find the report Dirty Metals, Mining, Communities, and the Environment on the web at nodirtygold.org. And the continuing campaign against trade in what are called conflict diamonds or blood diamonds was the subject of a news report on commondreams.org this past week. But we might find a more positive approach to a holiday celebrating love and the erotic. My remaining comments today are drawn from the work of black lesbian feminist poet Audre Lorde in her 1978 essay, Uses of the Erotic as Power. Lorde died in 1992, but her work lives on and continues to inspire many. This essay is available in her 1984 collection of essays, Sister Outsider. She writes, "The erotic offers a well of replenishing and provocative force to the woman who does not fear its revelation nor succumb to the belief that sensation is enough. The erotic is a measure between the beginnings of our sense of self and the chaos of our strongest feelings. It is an internal sense of satisfaction to which, once we have experienced it, we know we can aspire. For having experienced the fullness of this depth of feeling and recognizing its power, in honor and self-respect, we can require no less of ourselves. Within the celebration of the erotic in all our endeavors, my work becomes a conscious decision, a longed-for bed which I enter gratefully and from which I rise up empowered. Of course, women so empowered are dangerous, so we are taught to separate the erotic from the most vital areas of our lives other than sex. And the lack of concern for the erotic root and satisfactions of our work is felt in our disaffection from so much of what we do. For instance, how often do we truly love our work, even at its most difficult? The principal horror of any system which defines the good in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, or which defines human need to the exclusion of the psychic and emotional components of that need, the principal horror of such a system is that it robs our work of its erotic value, its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. Such a system reduces work to a travesty of necessities, a duty by which we earn bread or oblivion for ourselves and those we love. But this is tantamount to blinding a painter and then telling her to improve her work and to enjoy the act of painting. It is not only next to impossible, it is also profoundly cruel. The erotic functions for me in several ways, and the first is in providing the power which comes from sharing deeply any pursuit with another person. The sharing of joy, whether physical, emotional, or intellectual, forms a bridge between the sharers, which can be the basis for understanding much of what is not shared between them, and lessens the threat of their difference. Another way in which the erotic connection functions is the open and fearless underlining of my capacity for joy. In the way my body stretches to music and opens into response, hearkening to its deepest rhythms, so every level upon which I sense also opens to the erotically satisfying experience, whether it is dancing, building a bookcase, writing a poem, examining an idea. That self-connection shared is a measure of the joy which I know myself to be capable of feeling, a reminder of my capacity for feeling. And that deep and irreplaceable knowledge of my capacity for joy comes to demand from all of my life that it be lived within the knowledge that such satisfaction is possible and does not have to be called marriage, nor God, nor an afterlife. This is one reason why the erotic is so feared and so often relegated to the bedroom alone when it is recognized at all. For once we begin to feel deeply all the aspects of our lives, we begin to demand from ourselves and from our life pursuits that they feel in accordance with that joy which we know ourselves to be capable of. Our erotic knowledge empowers us, becomes a lens through which we scrutinize all aspects of our existence, forcing us to evaluate those aspects honestly in terms of their relative meaning within our lives. And this is a grave responsibility. Not to settle for the convenient, the shoddy, the conventionally expected, nor the merely safe. In touch with the erotic, I become less willing to accept powerlessness or those other supplied states of being which are not native to me, such as resignation, despair, self-effacement, depression, self-denial. Recognizing the power of the erotic within our lives can give us the energy to pursue genuine change within our world. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel reading from Audre Lorde's Uses of the Erotic as Power.
Hi, folks. Yes, read Audre Lorde's Uses of the Erotic. This is your Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM. We're about midway in the morning, Old Mole. We go on from 9 to 10, then Health Watch and the Dirt Bag, and then Democracy Now! At 11. We're going to play a love song now. Let's talk about sex.
Anything goes, let's tell it like it is and how it could be, how it was and of course how it should be. Those who think it's dirty have a choice, pick up the needle, press pause, or turn the radio off. Will that stop us, Pep? I doubt. Alright then, come on, spin.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and when me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Make any man's eyes pop. She uses his guys to get whatever she don't got. Fellas droop like fools, but then again, they're only human. This chick was a hit because her body was booming. Gold, pearl, ruby, crazy diamonds. Nothing she wore was ever common. Her date, heads of state, men of taste, lawyers, doctors. No one was too great for her to get with or even mess with. The press she says was next on her list. And
yes, let's talk about sex. And in fact, let's be erotic throughout life and really nurture good feelings and intellectual work, too. And radio work, Tammy, who's our engineer today, working really hard, getting all these cassettes in. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour again on KABU. Next on the Old Mole, we're going to be hearing from our movie moles, Jan and Fran Michel again, Jan Hocken. They're reviewing the film, Why We Fight.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Jan Hocken to discuss Why We Fight, the documentary by Eugene Jarecki, currently playing at Cinema 21. The film addresses the military-industrial congressional think tank complex that has grown up with American militarism since World War II, and the various motives for war. From the person on the street view that we fight for freedom, to the soldier's decision to enlist for employment and training, through the need to justify government spending on weapons that provide factory jobs and shareholder profits, as well as the neo-imperialist motive to maintain access to the markets and resources of other countries, especially the oil that powers the military. The film uses archival footage, such as clips of President Eisenhower giving the 1961 speech in which he warned of the military-industrial complex, as well as new interviews. Among those we hear from are Eisenhower's son and granddaughter, Chalmers Johnson, former CIA officer and author of Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, William Kristol, one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century, retired Pentagon official Karen Kwiatkowski, the two pilots who dropped the first bombs of Operation Iraqi Freedom in March 2003, a South Vietnamese refugee emigre who designed the bunker buster bombs, a retired New York City cop and Vietnam veteran whose son died on 9/11, a young man enlisting in the Army for lack of other options, and various others, both government officials and average citizens. We've been doing a kind of series here on the movie malls on anti-war films and what makes a film an anti-war film. How does this fit into that series that we've been doing? In what ways might this be an anti-war film?
We certainly are interested in going beyond the anti-Bush perspective and the contemporary neocons as important and delightful such critiques are to go after these people. But this film certainly goes beyond some of the films like Outfoxed, other films recently that address U.S. foreign policy and focus specifically on the far right by emphasizing a long-term systematic orientation toward foreign policy that involves Democratic and Republican administrations focused on the expansion of empire and economic interests throughout the world. So it really goes beyond the bad apple or the current moment to put at least attempt to put in some of the current war activity, including the war against Iraq, as part of a long series of interventions throughout the globe, U.S. establishing bases throughout the globe to open up markets for U.S. commercial interests. So the tie, too, between the military and capitalism is more at the center of this documentary than many of the others.
Yeah, and I think it provides information about moments in U.S. history that may be downplayed. They may be familiar to some of the regular listeners to the Old Mall, but maybe not part of general awareness, things like the U.S. role and the CIA's role in the overthrow of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mossadegh, who was then replaced by the Shah as a kind of puppet for Western powers that wanted continued access to Iranian oil reserves. And then his role as puppet led to opposition to him that resulted in the Khomeini government coming to power and the establishment of the current theocracy in Iran. So, I mean, from a current contemporary perspective today, that sometimes is treated as or looks like an instance of, well, they're just fanatics over there. It has nothing to do with a kind of global system, but in fact looked at in terms of the history of the 20th century and the U.S. involvement in that, we can see that we're actually fairly responsible for what's going on in Iran at the moment. There's lovely footage of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein.
Our former friend, our enemies.
Who's become, a problem for us. We do get a sense of the bigger picture, and that's really an advantage of this film, I think, over some others.
There's also some attempt to bring the humanity of the victims of war in perspective and some class perspective on how there's one young man who had few options in life who was recruited to serve in the Army, another New York cop who we are, I think, more than anyone kind of led to identify with the disillusionment with the ideal of the U.S. government and the president's protector, and has to come to terms after his son dies when the World Trade Towers come down. He is gung-ho on war and then comes to feel disillusioned by the deception behind it.
Yeah, and it seems like it may also lead to him to a kind of further critique of his own experience in Vietnam, because he also says, well, and Johnson lied about the Gulf of Tonkin, what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin, and then he discovers, you know, George W. Bush has lied about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So he does sort of make a journey of coming to develop some skepticism from having, as he puts it, once believed that the president walks on water and that the U.S. president is someone always to be trusted. So he's a figure whose disillusionment and whose sense of loss, not only of his son but of his belief in his country, is something that comes out in the course of the film. We don't see a lot of the impact of weapons on people in Iraq, although we do get a very strong sense that all of these supposedly precision-guided missiles are all, as it turns out, misguided and land on people's homes rather than on their intended targets. So we get some sense of the suffering of what's known as collateral damage.
And a systematic propaganda effort to minimize and downplay the cost of war, both on the side of the country that's victim of the attacks as well as on this side. I think one of the costs in this galloping through history and this wide sweeping view that includes World War II, Capra's propaganda films, that was the basis of the title Why We Fight, that there was some lovely footage of these propaganda films that seem frightfully close to the present, actually. But
just very slightly over the top of what we see today.
Right, that's right. But in moving back and forth and through the Cold War, World War II, the Cold War, and then 9/11, and this ongoing war against terrorism, the picture that emerges is a kind of seamless march on the part of people in power through history, stomping on everything in their path, and you don't have any sense of the difference between the Cold War and the current campaign against terrorism or splits or divisions within the U.S. or the U.S. government. It ends up as the parallel between the Roman Empire and the U.S. Empire is almost too compelling, because it feels almost unmovable and overpowering in its grasp and its reach.
Yeah, well, on the one hand, we do get some articulation of the idea that capitalism and democracy are not, after all, at odds in the way that they are, I mean, are at odds, are not the sort of seamless single system that they're sometimes presented as being in popular culture in the U.S. We don't get a sense of the way that democracy or grassroots activism or people's, you know, democratic actions can actually have some effect on the larger public sphere or the possibility of effecting some kinds of change in the world.
There is some emphasis on the growing and historically unprecedented hostility around the world toward the U.S. empire, and yet, on the other hand, it's presented as kind of scattered outrage, and you don't have a sense of any of the systematic movements and critiques on the part of the left and anti-war forces here or elsewhere. It's a kind of spontaneous outrage that periodically appears in the film.
And there is some attention to the massive protests around the world against the war before it started. The millions of people who showed up at anti-war demonstrations in February of 2003, for instance. But most of the attention about those goes to demonstrations in other parts of the world, and we get much less attention to the fact that there was a lot of mobilization in the U.S. even then, and we don't get any attention to the idea that, in fact, there continues to be mobilization in the U.S. against the war on terror and the war in Iraq.
The title of the film, I think, suggests this very problem: why we fight. There's almost too much of an acceptance of the we-ness. Periodically, you have shots of that in some ways were or problematic shots of people who are overweight eating fast food in restaurants, and the implication is, well, we all are kind of implicated, as we are in a sense, in what our government does. On the other hand, the notion that we are fighting, I think, downplays how many are fighting against this kind of fight And you don't have enough, I think, emphasis on how people do become enlisted in wars that are against their interests.
Yeah, I mean, many of the reviews of this film have commented on its even-handedness and its reasonableness, as opposed to something like Fahrenheit 9/11, where we get, you know, a much more sort of boisterous and comedic and view and critique of U.S. militarism, where a lot of viewers have felt like with Michael Moore's film, you sort of have to be on his side to begin with. I mean, it's preaching to the converted, as it were, whereas this seems more even-handed, in part because we get so much attention to and so much, we hear so much from voices on the right, and we get much less response from those on the left or those who are critical of what's going on. And so we don't get the same sense that there is a kind of active mobilization going on.
And there's a little commentary from Gore Vidal, but I think in other ways, though, these military men and statesmen are presented in this close, heavy way, that the heaviness and their age comes through in a very powerful way filmically. You almost have the sense that these guys are dying out. They're an end of an era. I mean, they look very old, even older, I think, than they actually are. And yet there is the legacy of the Eisenhower family, which is a theme throughout as well. Dwight D. Eisenhower has been throughout the peace movement, apparently, the liberal peace movement, resuscitated as a leftist and a peacenik of his era, which seems a bit odd.
Deeply ironic, I would say, actually. I mean, because, of course, Eisenhower was responsible for U.S. interventions abroad and for involvement in the Korean War, involvement in the CIA's overthrowing of Mossadegh in Iran. I mean, it's not as though he was innocent of all this, and he was certainly arguing for the buildup of the military, and yet right before he left office, he warned of its dangers. And as a result, he's become this sort of touchstone, certainly for this film and maybe more broadly, as you're suggesting.
His son and granddaughter cast him as kind of the Cassandra of the modern era, warning of all of the militarism getting out of control, and also commenting, apparently, that it's a good thing there's a general in charge who really knows how the military operates. I fear for the day when someone who's not a military man runs this kind of power, superpower.
Yeah, and Eisenhower suggests that
we also have to be careful of the economic interests behind the military as well as the military itself.
And Jarecki at one point in an interview, not in the film, but comments that he realizes that a country is far gone in militarism when you're looking to figures from the military to critique the military. But the film does kind of come off as a sort of love letter to Eisenhower in a lot of ways.
So, happy Valentine's Day, Dwight D. Eisenhower and your heirs.
For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle and Jan Hocken discussing Why We Fight, playing at Cinema 21 in Portland.
Well, thanks to our movie moles on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Just reviewed Why We Fight. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm here for our last bit on the show with Fred Hewitt. Fred Hewitt's an activist energy coordinator at the Sierra Club. He works with Jobs with Justice on the Jobs with Justice's Labor and Global Warming Working Group, tentative title. Fred Hewitt, welcome to KABU.
Good morning. Glad to be back in KABU, actually.
Uh-huh.
It's been a little while.
Fred, tell us about the work that both the Sierra Club and Jobs with Justice are doing on climate change and changing energy structures.
Well, the Sierra Club's been working on climate change energy issues for a long time. In the last year or so, it's become a much higher priority for us. There was a big summit meeting in September in San Francisco, a national meeting with about 800 people there from all over the country, and they voted for clean energy, global warming, sort of set of issues to be our a very high priority for what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
In the labor movement, there's an increasing interest in this issue just in general because it affects everybody, and it will also have an impact on conditions and employment for workers and the future of the country, basically, and of the world.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to that. Let's really talk about what it means for workers. But first, I know you've been keeping track of, with the Bush administration, just denying there was any problem even for a long time and trying to sink the Kyoto Treaty and basically sandbag on any effort to even think or talk about it. That did, in fact, stimulate a lot of effort on local levels to begin engaging with it and changing sort of our energy posture. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's been local activity on this issue for a long time, and Oregon's had an energy planning process that deals with global climate since the early 1990s. Portland, as I recall correctly, the Portland Global Warming Plan was first put in place in 1993, one of the first in the country, one of the first in the world, actually. Under the Clinton administration, at least there was a lot of attention paid to the issue, although you can argue about how effective they were in dealing with it. But the Clinton administration did support the Kyoto Treaty and did do a lot to boost research and early work to actually start addressing the issue.
Now, they also brought cases against the really huge polluting coal-powered plants in the Midwest, right? I mean, these were
right.
Really...
Well, because of the Clean Air Act amendments in 1990, there was an effort to tighten up the standards for that. But actually, that fight goes back to the 70s and the effort to reduce or phase out the old really dirty coal plants in the Ohio Valley, particularly partly because of acid rain, but also because of other kinds of pollutants. And increasingly, it's understood that coal is one of our main contributors to CO2. I might want to mention to everybody that about 45% of the electricity in Oregon is coal-generated. We don't really see it because there's only one coal plant in the state at Boardman, which isn't really visible from the, you know, from the big highways. There's one up in Washington State at Centralia, but most of it is over in Wyoming. So you think of Oregon as being a hydro electricity, well, it certainly is, but about half, nearly half of our electricity is from coal, so we have the same problem.
And pouring carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, these plants do.
That's right.
Along with the rest of this stuff that goes up the
Boardman state. Plant is by far the biggest single emitter of carbon dioxide in the state.
Mm-hmm. What can be done about that?
About Boardman specifically
well, that,
or about the
that,
overall
that's one
issue?
Source. Then let's talk about the two sources and then get back to working people. One is these big, huge electric power plants that emit so much. The second one, of course, is vehicles that emit so much. And I know that there are things going on in both areas.
Well, vehicles are maybe not. Well, you can argue about the proportions, but transportation is the other big sector.
Right.
Electric power generation and transportation are the two big sectors, although there are others for producing greenhouse gases. In both sectors, there are significant things that we can do. We're really not very efficient in this country in using energy, so there's a huge opportunity in both areas for making things more efficient and also actually in improving, increasing jobs, increasing employment mm-hmm. around the country. You know, it's a labor-intensive approach rather than a capital-intensive
yeah.
approach.
But let's talk about the emissions standards raising and then get back to the labor-intensive.
Sure. Well, Oregon's following the lead of California and a lot of other states around the country in moving toward a higher tailpipe emission standard. The Environmental Quality Commission adopted a temporary standard back in December, and they're now considering a full-scale rule. This month is the public comment month, so you can go to, if you want to find out more information about this, we have a website that the Sierra Club participates in called cleancarsoregon.org. The Clean Cars for Oregon Coalition was started by the Oregon Environmental Council and a lot of groups, OSPRG, Sierra Club, OEC, the Lung Association, Ecumenical Ministries, and many other organizations and groups belong to that. The
IGA, Jobs with Justice. I
Jobs with Justice
yeah.
is participating in it as well. That effort is aimed at supporting the clean car emission standards that came out of California. The interesting thing about those new standards is not only do they address the pollutants that we normally think about that cause air pollution when you have a lot of cars and trucks, but also the idea instituted in California in 2002 is to reduce global warming emissions, carbon dioxide primarily. The reason being that when you have warmer temperatures, that raises the level of smog and other kinds of pollutants, so that, in fact, global warming causes more health problems, especially in urban areas with a lot of cars and trucks. So they've tied it all together now, and these increased standards, which California is allowed to adopt under the Clean Air Act, other states can adopt those exact same standards if we want to go well ahead of the federal
standards. And if enough states do it, the car companies have to comply. They cannot give up California, Oregon, and Washington.
Right, because it would be difficult for anybody to make, at some point it's more difficult for the companies to make two different kinds of cars for the market, for the national market. So there's definitely a strategy of a tipping point strategy. About when Oregon comes in, about 35% to 40% of the North American car and truck market will be under these new standards.
Apparently, New York State is also
a number. Yeah. That's right.
They can't give up those big states.
A number of New England states, and also the country of Canada, which didn't obviously can't adopt the California standards directly, but they have a deal with the auto industry that's actually voluntary, so that the noises the auto industry was making here. We really can't do this. It's too much for us to do. They've gone to Canada and said, well, we can in fact do this. The deal is structured a little differently than the U.S. standards, but basically aimed at the same direction. So the idea is to have more efficient vehicles on the road. We haven't seen an increase in fuel economy in 20 years. This is not a fuel economy standard. It's an emissions standard. It's a pollution standard,
right.
But it has the effect of reducing fuel usage.
And you can learn more about it at cleancarsoregon.org.
That's right.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Fred Hewitt, who does a lot of energy work with the Sierra Club and Jobs of Justice. Fred, let's get back to the Jobs of Justice issue and why they're part of, in fact, the coalition in Oregon. And again, people can testify and should, in fact, think about testifying at those hearings and coming to the hearings and being a force for insisting on the emission standards.
Right. There's no question that clean energy is good for working people. For one thing, it means more jobs in the community. In the non-transportation sector, the electricity sector especially, what we're talking about is doing more, to use more energy more efficiently, you have to have insulation, more efficient motors, more efficient lighting. This requires people like electricians and carpenters and building operators. Those are jobs in the community. Those are things that happen right here and increase the demand for those kinds of skills, not to mention the clerical and support work that is also necessary to keep those operations going. And one thing we know for sure about energy efficiency is you have to have high quality. The quality makes all the difference in the performance of all those measures. And so the labor movement offers the training and the support, the apprenticeship programs, the general knowledge that's necessary to keep quality high. This is exceptionally important and I think an underappreciated aspect of what we can be
and
seeing
also,
in the next few years.
And also, high wages keep quality high because people with decent wages gain commitments to their work and don't look for something from their $7 an hour job, an $8 an hour job, and leave after 6 months.
A lot of it's about expectations and building the experience base that you get with a well-employed workforce will pay off directly in terms of better functioning equipment buildings and so on.
One final thing before we sign off. It seems to me, in reconstructing the energy industry, not just the conservation side, but reconstructing the energy industry, we can think about technologies that also offer good jobs and where the community and workers themselves are really participating in meaningful ways in planning these and the way the firms operate.
This is especially important in the energy sector. I think that one of the things people understood about the hurricanes in the Gulf Coast was that area is a tremendously heavily impacted area for the environment and most importantly for the people who work in those plants. The oil, chemical, and atomic workers who now are part of the steel workers, they formed a union called PACE, and that's just merged with the steel workers. They represent the people in those areas, quite a lot of them, and they are suffering the direct effects of the really dirty oil industry, manufacturing and refining processes that occur there. We ought to think about how to improve conditions there because we're going to be using oil and gas for a long time.
Fred Hewitt, thanks a lot for coming to Cable
very
and talking
glad to, be
to
here.
Us. We talked really fast and got a lot of information in. Thank you very much. I'm going to sign off now with a lot of thank yous and with some information. I remember our first interviews with Carol Dyer and Sakura Kone of Common Ground Relief in New Orleans. People want to get involved or give money or learn more about them and their effort to actually build commons, New Orleans commons, and to restore working class and poor neighborhoods. Look on the web at Common Ground Relief. We also add Fran Michel, read from Audre Lorde's The Uses of the Erotic. You might want to read that. And Fred Hewitt, thanks again for being here. And in fact, where's your website? I have it written down here. Oh, cleancarsoregon.org gives information on the coming emission standards struggle. Bye-bye. That's all for the Old Mole.
And it's 10 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. He interviews Dr. Nisa Goldberg, author of the Women's Health Heart Program, Healthy Heart Program, Life-Saving Strategies for Preventing and Healing Heart Disease. And at 10:30, the Dirtbag host, Glenn Andreessen, discusses with Ted Swenson the topic of fruit trees. So that stay tuned for that. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman interviews author Alice Walker for the entire hour.